Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to the Slash Filmcast, the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. I'm Devendra Hardwar, and today I'm joined with...
Jeff Cannata.
Hey, Jeff. And Dave Chen is not with us today. He had to step out. But joining us for the review of Shazam, a movie I've been looking forward to for a while, is Griffin Newman from the Blank Check podcast and Amazon's The Tick. And I'm expecting that's going to be a fun conversation. As
yeah,
always.
Devendra, yeah. I should apologize to everybody listening because you know, a lot of people noted last week that I did not do a limerick
in the
Matrix episode. I thought it was not a new movie. We're not really reviewing it. It was
what
more
could
like
happen?
Checking it.
Yeah.
What's the worst that could happen? Well, we found out the worst that could happen. Dave got irate. I've never seen him like that. It was frankly terrifying.
Yeah.
And now he's not here this week. So you guys put two and two together. He threatened to, you know, never come back. So hopefully we can get him to come back next week. But I apologize to everyone because I know you guys expect Dave Chen to be here. And it's my fault for not having the limerick. So
thanks a lot, Jeff.
I apologize.
It's all your fault.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we really don't have much on our plate today. We do have a couple things to talk about that we've been watching that we didn't mention during last week's show. So I'm going to get that started. I've been watching Love, Death, and Robots, the
Ooh.
New Netflix anthology series. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's created by Tim Miller, the director of Deadpool, and also produced by David Fincher. And I think it's a series that has a lot of both of their sensibilities in mind. I think the title is very apt. There's a lot of love. More like a lot of sex and death and robots. Like it's a cool riff on science fiction and basically adult oriented science fiction. So kind of reminds me of like MTV's, what was it? Liquid TV back in
yeah,
the day.
Yeah, like Aeon Flux and stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff. It's fun. I'm really enjoying it. I think some shorts are better than others, or about like 10 to 15 minutes each. Some definitely feel like, oh, this is definitely something that probably came from the mind of David Fincher. Like, one recurring theme for some reason is violence against women as a plot point. Not cool. Also really weird because then sometimes some of the shorts are just like fun things of like, you know, robots walking through the, you know, human apocalypse and telling jokes to each other. So it's just... It's all over the place. I really like some episodes, really don't care for others. One, I believe, it's called When the Yogurt Took Over, which is based on a John Scalzi short story.
Oh.
And it's narrated by the guy who did, what's his name? The voice of The Brain from Pinky and the Brain.
Oh, okay.
Famous voice actor whose name is escaping me right now. But it's like a 3-minute thing of just this like crazy idea of super sentient yogurt. And how that, you know, leads to the end or the hope of humanity. But it's such a beautiful little sci-fi piece. Like, go watch it right now. If you haven't checked out the series, just go watch that episode. I think that encapsulates the best of this idea of, you know, love, death, and robots, basically. I think you'd love that, Jeff. It's so much fun.
I have to be honest. I was a little turned off after I learned that it's just a bunch of shorts that aren't really connected to one another. I don't know. It to me, that feels, I don't know why that's such a turnoff to me. I think that's just, it feels like it's not going to add up to anything.
Yeah.
Does it feel like a bunch of music videos, or is it more substantial than that?
It kind of does. It does kind of feel like, you know, just people riffing on their ideas of science fiction. But I think each of the episodes also has really cool animation. So it's also really cool to see these people just to get their animation techniques and a way to get their ideas out there. I think it's a lot like the Animatrix without the connecting tissue of the Matrix.
Right.
You know, give it a shot. I can't guarantee you'll like every one, but certainly the yogurt one is very good, and the one about the robots just walking through the apocalypse is hilarious. There's so many great gags in that.
Well, I do love me some John Scalzi. That guy is an awesome author, so I might check that out.
He's doing real good these days. Yeah, and what have you seen, Jeff?
Oh, there's quite a bit. We didn't really have time for what we've been watching last week, so catching up on some stuff. I watched all of Catastrophe Season 4. Catastrophe is a show I've talked about before on the show, and I think you watched it as well, right?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, it is it's a show I really like, and this is not just the fourth season, it's also the final season of the show about an American and an Irish woman who have a one-night stand that results in a pregnancy, and then he moves over to, I believe, London?
Yes.
London with her to live. And now we're in the fourth season. The show is really dark. I mean,
so dark.
There is an honesty where they mine their comedy that borders on just meanness.
Yeah.
You know, it is like characters who say what they feel in the moment in a raw and brutal way that sometimes, I mean, there are moments in this fourth season where people say just ugly, awful things to each other.
It's
people
brutal.
Who are married and in love, you know, and then they brush it off two scenes later. You know, it's a tone that doesn't always land on me well. Sometimes it feels like, man, these people are just awful to one another. But I also, there's a heart in it, and there is an honesty with regard to how difficult some things are in life, and how difficult it is to cohabitate and deal with life's ups and downs. And the real, I mean, there's, this season has like alcoholism fallout and stuff like that. And then it ends in a really powerful, enigmatic way that has stuck with me. I wish we could talk about the specifics of it, because I was like, did I just see what I think I saw?
It's open-ended in a way that I think is perfectly fitting for what the show is getting at. Basically, like, you know, life takes you places and you're going to take chances and you don't know what'll happen, basically.
Right.
But you do it because of love. I really enjoyed this final season. I definitely hear you, Jeff. Like, it's such a unique tone of people being mean to each other. But I think it's also the sort of thing where, like, you look at these people, Rob Delaney's character and Sharon Horgan's character, and you just think these people deserve each other in a way.
Yeah.
Like, they both, like, they are both kind of mean and misanthropic in the same way. And at the same time, they find a connection through that. And I wonder, like, would they, it's almost like a true love type thing. Like, could they find other people who really connect with them on that same level? I kind of don't think so. So it's weird how this is at the same time, to me, kind of a true love story.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think they find that too, in a way. Like, they acknowledge that they are made for each other in a cosmic way, you know. This is a series I would recommend without reservation, but also
be prepared. Yeah.
Be prepared. And it didn't always make me feel good. And that's okay. Like, it at times it's like, whoa, that is harsh.
Mm-hmm.
But really interesting. And characters, the kind of characters you don't really see on television much.
Yeah. So. Do you watch You're the Worst, Jeff?
I do.
It's very similar.
Similar. Yeah. In the way that these people are sort of awful to one another, but like, because they're both awful, they sort of belong together. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think Catastrophe has more bite to it.
Oh, definitely. It is much sharper. I think because these characters and the actors and writers are just older too. Like, there's a lot more experience there that makes it more biting. Whereas,
and higher stakes.
Yeah. Higher stakes. You're the Worst is like, you know, your 20s and 30 somethings, just like trying to survive the hellscape of that. Yeah.
Yeah. The worst thing that can happen to the people in You're the Worst is, like, you know, they get drunk and say awful things. And that, you know, and then, you know, people in Catastrophe are like, this is our life. We have children. You know, the stakes are high. But it's a good show. It's a good show. And I think I like shows that know when to exit stage left, you know, and leave on a high note. And this one certainly does that, I think.
Excellent.
I've also been watching the new Ricky Gervais show on Netflix called Afterlife. And this is a very short show, only a few episodes. I watched it in one sitting.
Huh.
I think it's six. I think it's six episodes, 6 half-hour episodes. So yeah, 3 hours. I watched it in one sitting, and by the end, I was crying those like fat tears, you know, like those big fat tears that you get. Mm-hmm. I really love this show. I am a fan of Ricky Gervais. He's problematic sometimes, and not
kind
you know,
of a jerk. Yeah,
he can be a jerk, yeah. And I have to admit. A lot of this show is like, oh, this is just an excuse for Ricky Gervais to be a jerk.
Oh, boy.
And say his jerky things. And that's one reading of it. And it's legit. Like, I think this is an excuse for him to do like stand-up material where he's like, God, I wish I could say this to a person. And then he writes a scene where he says that to a person, you know. But it is also this treatise on why we should all live. I mean, the show is about a guy who lost his wife about a year ago, I think, in the timeline of the show, and is suicidal, like doesn't think that there's any reason to go on living because he loved his wife so much. And she was such a big part of his life. He starts in a place that I have to admit I could relate to in a sense that he looks at the world and goes, people are awful. Awful people win. There's no one held accountable for being terrible to other people. It is just a, you know, get mine, screw everyone else over.
Yeah.
And I hate it. But why should I put in any effort? Because that's how the world works. And over the course of the show, it's getting to a place of realizing why we should go on living, why we should be here for our fellow man, why the world can be beautiful and what our purpose is in it. And it's exquisite. I mean, it is really lovely, and it's heartfelt, and it's sweet at times. It's funny. It's hardcore. Like, I mean, he's a suicidal guy. Like, they don't mince words about it. Like, he wants to kill himself, but comes to this place of appreciating the magic of being good and why we should all be good to each other. And that journey made me cry. It touched me. I really thought this show was excellent, and I highly recommend Afterlife.
Yeah. I want to check it out at some point. I do feel like Ricky Gervais's persona really makes it hard for me to swallow his more sensitive and sweet things. And I know he's tried this with movies, and not all of his movies have worked for me. He's a tough nut to crack, right? Because sometimes I feel like. When he's saying things like this, is he just being hypocritical? Because you're not living your life the way, you know, the message of the show seems to be. But yeah, glad to hear you liked it, Jeff. And hopefully I'll make time for that soon.
Yeah, you know, I totally relate to what you just said. And I agree with it. But I also feel like the one thing I admire about him and this is that, like, if you're going to make art, why not make it about this? Why not make it about the biggest questions of, like, literally – why go on living?
True.
Why should I go on living and not kill myself? And, you know, it's a big question, but it's sort of – I found myself thinking while watching this, you know, he's taking big swings. You know, he's – if he's going to make something, he's going to talk about the biggest stuff. And I kind of dig that, and I kind of respect it. So
definitely.
Yeah, I liked it.
And what next, Jeff?
I also – very excitedly tuned in to the new What We Do in the Shadows TV show, because I am such a huge fan of that movie. And, you know, I adore that movie. I think it is genius and so well executed. And the TV show, I think, is good too, but you can't help but feel like it's sort of the B team or like a cover band or something. Yeah. Matt Berry is in the TV show, and I love Matt Berry.
I'm watching this mainly for Matt Berry. Yes. I'll watch anything he's in. Yeah.
I agree. He is brilliant and hilarious. Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, Toast of London.
I love
his shows. I love him. He's so funny. And he's inspired casting for this. He's great in it. And I think everybody in it's pretty good, and they're doing the same shtick, and maybe that's the problem in a sense, because right. the movie is so good. You just can't help but feel like, oh, this is a cover band. But, you know, but, you know, it's a cover band of songs I like. So I liked it. But you watched it too, right?
I watched it. I really enjoyed it. I mean, I think this is where were the characters actually located in the movie? Was that actually New Zealand or Australia, or was that also America?
I can't remember. I think it was New Zealand. Okay. I think that's a big change for the show.
The idea. Like, this, it is basically the B team, but it's like these dinosaurs that have just been in Staten Island for hundreds of years. I like that concept, and it is kind of hilarious seeing them exist in the real world. There's one character who plays an emotional vampire.
Dude, it's which such is a brilliant idea.
Brilliant idea. Great actors. Essentially, like playing Milton from Office Space, but as somebody who sucks your soul as he's talking to you. And that's also like, these people exist too. Like, it's so real. It's so good.
He's a legit vampire. Like, he's a straight up vampire. Everybody acknowledges he is a vampire, but he dresses like a normal guy. And his super vampire power is he just sucks the life out of you by droning on endlessly.
That even the vampires have to run away from him because he's the only person that can suck life from a vampire.
He's the only person that can vampire a vampire. It's so great.
So it's stuff like that, like the little stuff. And I think a particularly well-known genre actor appears towards the end of the first episode. And I really like the concept of what they build up.
Yeah. Yes. I have high hopes. I'm going to keep watching it, but it's sort of unfair to judge it by the movie.
Yes.
But you sort of can't help yourself. You know, like it's the movie is so brilliant. And I think, I think it's great. It's a great concept and really funny.
And I guess you're also – there's something else you want to talk about, Jeff.
Well, it's my yearly come out of the closet as a wrestling fan moment, because this last weekend was WrestleMania 35. And so I just wanted to mention it. And I only talk about wrestling once a year. And I, to be honest, watch wrestling only a few times a year these days, what with having children. Man – it was an uneven WrestleMania this year, but it had some great moments. And one of them I just want to outline for you because I'm sure there's a lot of people listening to this that look down on wrestling, that think wrestling is stupid. And I just want to tell you about the storytelling there's a match with Kofi Kingston and Daniel Bryan for the WWE Championship. Okay. Now, Daniel Bryan, who is the current, was into this match, was the current WWE champion. He is this diminutive looking guy. He's got a big, long, scraggly beard. And for years and years and years, years ago, he was the consummate underdog. He's a smaller guy in a company, the WWE, that really elevates giant humans, you know. And he was a hard worker who kind of threw himself around the ring and had charm and but he just wasn't getting his shot. And he sort of came upon this new catchphrase where he would point his two fingers up in the air and say yes, 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 and the whole crowd would start chanting yes, yes, yes. And so he became more and more popular. People loved that interactive element
by the power of the catchphrase.
By the power of the catchphrase, which is, you know, part of what I love about wrestling. It is a truly interactive art form. It is a truly interactive it's like part stunt show, part Greek theater where the audience is shouting at, you know, it's part improvisation. It's great. So this is the backstory. Daniel Bryan, he becomes the WWE champion against all odds years ago. And then he has a big injury. They say he's actually not going to be able to wrestle anymore. Goes away for a long time, comes back as what he's calling himself, the new Daniel Bryan, where he turned heel. So he's actually a bad guy now.
Gotta love
it. He's the man. He is the guy who is holding people down and not letting people move forward. And he's got like bigger dudes as his enforcers.
Every wrestling hero, you know, live long enough to become the heel, basically.
Exactly.
Right?
Totally true. But it's brilliant because this guy was like the fan favorite, and now people don't like him, and he makes fun of them. But you know, so he's
Jeff. I survived Hulkmania. I know how this goes.
Well, let me tell you about the storytelling. Okay, uh-huh. So that's just the backstory of the bad guy in this match. Kofi Kingston is this charming younger dude. He's been around in WWE for 11 years. Started out as a singles wrestler, wowed people with his athleticism. Black guy who never really got a shot, and then he was put in. Just a few years ago, was put in a tag team with two other guys. They call themselves New Day, and they have become this really fun, irreverent tag team. One of the guys comes to the ring with a trombone and goes, and they have like a breakfast cereal, and they called Bootios, and it's ridiculous, but. By sheer force of their own will and sheer creativity of their own, you know, wackiness, they have won over the crowd and have become this fun thing. They were tag team champions anyway. But Kofi Kingston, he sort of had dreams of being a singles wrestling superstar. Okay. So he's trying to have this singles push where he's moving his way up. And the storyline is Daniel Bryan is not going to let him do it. Daniel Bryan keeps calling him a B-plus performer, right? He's not in the A league. He's not going to make it. He never can do it. But Kofi Kingston keeps trying and keeps trying and keeps trying. And they, you know, over the course of months, they throw crazy stuff at him. They make him fight five people in one night. And he's by the hair on his chinny chin chin, he just scrapes by and manages to get he fights all five guys in one night and beats all of them. These are major dudes, and he does it. He does it. And then Daniel Bryan comes out and says, oh, the last guy you beat all five guys, well, now you have to beat me. And he comes down, he cheats with his enforcer and kicks the crap out of Kofi Kingston. And so no, you're not going to get your title shot. Oh, so clutch from the jaws of victory, a defeat. Right. So what happens next? Well, his best buddies, the guys in New Day, they're like, no, he deserves a shot. We got to do it. And they're like, OK, well, oh, by the way, during his like five guys in one night thing, New Day is backstage like cheering him on and rooting for him. You know,
I really hope animates this whole discussion with you as a narrator, Jeff, just to break down what happened. Yeah.
So then. Daniel Bryan and Vince McMahon get this nefarious scheme, right? They'll give Kofi Kingston a shot, but now New Day has to fight a bunch of people and go through their own gauntlet. And Kofi Kingston, he can't help them in any way. So now he's backstage, and his best friends are the guys that are selflessly getting the crap kicked out of them to help their friend get a title shot. But they're doing it because they love him. It's like this amazing storyline, and they do it. They beat all the challengers. They go through all the tag teams that Vince McMahon and Daniel Bryan throw up against them, and they do it, and they get Kofi Kingston his title shot at WrestleMania. So that brings us to WrestleMania 35, the title shot.
Okay.
Kofi Kingston. And, I mean, long story short, he wins. But it is this, like, incredible moment of elevation. 11 years. New Day is on the, you know, at ringside, rooting him on, banging on the thing. The crowd is hyped. They're calling it Kofi Mania. It's just emotional catharsis moment that transcends the fiction of the storyline and becomes about this guy who always dreamed about being a singles wrestling superstar and always dreamed about being a champion. Working hard for 11 years, putting in the hours, putting in the time, in reinventing himself, coming up with new things, and he finally does it. He finally reaches the pinnacle, getting his own belt, getting the WWE Championship. And then at the end of it, he like brings his kids into the ring, and they pull out t-shirts saying that they won, and it's like beautiful. So that was a very long story, but it is – and you
was,
know,
was
the
it
show
a good WrestleMania, Jeff?
There was other really low moments in the show, but that was a high moment.
How long is a WrestleMania at this point?
It's like 17 hours. Jeez. It's very, I think they're like 4 or 5 hours long at this point. It's a very long show. But there's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of ups and downs. It's a very uneven thing, but it's the Super Bowl of wrestling.
That's cool.
And I've rarely ever gone into this much detail about why I love it, but that's an example of why I love it.
Listen, Jeff, like, this is a safe space. You love what you love. I mean, as people were talking about wrestling, I was watching, I was watching JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, which is this anime series. It's sort of like, it starts as this an English period piece that ends up being about super strong guys fighting each other to the death. So it's essentially wrestling. Like, it is, it's like, okay. So I realized, I may not be into wrestling, but I'm basically watching the same thing. I totally get it. I'm surprised, Jeff, that nobody has really done wrestling for like, I guess the modern age. Like, I'm surprised there's no real like streaming support or anything, or are these things available as like a cut down for people to just buy and watch like what's happens? Like, what is the modern state of wrestling right now?
Well, it is all streaming. I mean, WWE makes its money at this point. They have an app and they have a subscription service to a lot of content on that app. And whole channel's worth of
stuff. There's nobody else outside WWE at this point, right? I know New Japan, also people really like that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few federations that actually are going strong. I've always sort of been a WWE guy. As far as the cut down thing, one of the things that I think has always been the biggest strength of the WWE, even back to the WWF days, is they have some of the best – talk about trailers. They have some of the best trailer editors. They have some of the best – invariably at WrestleMania and at other big moments, before a match, they'll show you like the 2 years that led up to that match in 2 minutes. And they'll show these big moments and they'll have dramatic music and it'll compress an entire very protracted storyline into something really clear and concise. And that's one of the things I love about it, is it's like, oh yeah, I got amped up because I just saw this huge long storyline cut down and shown to me, and it's big moments and it feels this impactful thing. And now I'm going to see the culmination of that, because basically WrestleMania is the end of the season. It's like where all the storylines peak. So they do a great job of that stuff.
Excellent. Are you streaming? Are you doing the app at this point?
Yeah.
For everything?
Yeah.
How much is that? Yeah. I remember them being gouging like everything back in the pay-per-view days.
There was a chant, $9.99. It's $10 a month. But, I tend to cancel for months at a time. And they were running a promotion where it was like $10 for 3 months around WrestleMania.
Yeah,
it's not bad. Yeah.
Yeah. That seems fun. Well, thank you, Jeff. Congrats on your WrestleMania. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And that brings us to our review of Shazam.
Crazy, right?
What are your superpowers?
Superpowers, dude? I don't even know how to pee in this thing.
This is proof of authenticity. Super strength. Electricity manipulation. Hyper speed.
I'd like to purchase some of your finest beer, please.
And Sparkle Fingers.
No, it's not. That's not my name.
Chosen One.
Oh, you're like a bad guy, right?
You literally did the opposite of what a superhero is supposed to do.
And that was from the trailer for Shazam, David F. Sandberg's adaptation of the famous comic. I'll just read the description here from IMDb. This is probably one of the most elaborate IMDb descriptions I've read in some time. We all have a superhero inside us. It just takes a bit of magic to bring it out. In Billy Batson's case, by shouting out one word, Shazam, this streetwise 14-year-old foster kid can turn into the grown-up superhero, Shazam. Now that's a summary. Really, that's the movie right there.
Telling the same story over and over again.
So it goes. And that voice is Griffin Newman, joining us here from the Blank Check podcast. How's it going?
It's going all right. Thank you guys for giving me an opportunity to talk Shazam. I was telling you, we've been covering a lot of the DC movies on my podcast. And then we announced that we weren't going to cover this one, and people have been irate. So I appreciate riots having some outlet. Riots in the streets. Yeah. Trump won't stop tweeting about it.
Yeah.
It's been like a big to do.
I haven't been keeping tabs on this drama. Yeah. Why the decision not to cover this one?
We've always been Blank Check. We're like director based. We pick a director and we go through all
of
our movies.
Feel free to pitch it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It's about career arcs and filmography. So we pick someone who we think at some point achieved Blank Check status and got to make whatever kind of crazy movies they wanted and the ups and downs of their career from there. We did a one-off episode on Batman versus Superman, or I'm sorry, Batman v Superman.
Yes.
When it came out.
Dawn of Justice, sir.
Dawn of Justice. I'm sorry. BVS DOJ. when it was coming out, it seemed like such a weird Blank Check movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were really letting Zack Snyder do whatever he wanted, including coming up with the strangest titling structure of all time. And we weren't planning on doing like all the DC movies or doing all of Zack Snyder's movies. But then when Suicide Squad came out, it felt like another one that we had to talk about. So there became this running thing of us doing like emergency episodes whenever a DC movie came out, because they kind of seemed to be weirdly like simultaneously movies that were very Blank Checky and anti Blank Check. Like they're very much those directors' voices, but then they also felt like they were weird, like studio monstrosities.
Yeah.
With Warner Brothers trying to replicate this Marvel model. And now as they've become more and more functional, we're like, well, I don't know if we need to keep talking about them because now they actually have become like truly director driven movies, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's less this feeling of like this weird, like lumbering behemoth of like DC trying to copy Marvel's model and more.
Thank
just
God
like,
these for are, that.
Like, right. These are just like pretty functional movies that feel like they represent their individual directors' voices now pretty cleanly. And then the other problem is we just like have so many things we promised to do on the podcast that we're just finishing up Tim Burton now.
Mm-hmm.
And our plan was to like finish all of Tim Burton's films right in time for Dumbo to come out. But now our Dumbo episode's coming out a month late because of all the other things people have like requested we do. So it was like, we're not going to have Dumbo be 5 weeks late. No one's going to want to talk about Dumbo 5 weeks after. So
nobody
Shazam
wants to talk
just
about
felt like,
Dumbo
right,
anyway.
Barely now. Right. So we were like, I guess we cut Shazam because it doesn't feel like,
aww.
Even when David saw it early, he was like, it's really good. I don't know what, you know, how much it fits into what we talk about in our show, but it's just like very fun.
Yeah, you're always welcome here to chat about whatever offshoots, maybe that doesn't fit into the Blank Check model. I will say, this movie could be the beginning of David F. Sandberg's Blank Check status, because it's doing very well.
Yeah.
It is, and he's had a really like interesting career arc that very much mirrors a lot of the people we talk about. If you look at the jump from like him doing like a self-produced short film to doing Lights Out to Annabelle 2.
Which is good.
You know, creation. Yeah. And then to this, it's like a pretty, you know, we kind of bemoan the fact that you don't see people slowly building their career, that very often you get the person who makes the like $250,000 Sundance movie and then gets a $200 million blockbuster. And that's not really good for either. That doesn't help a director learn how to like grow.
Yes.
And I think it also gives the studio a lot of power to steamroll whoever's directing the movie. And like, this is a guy who's like had a nice little growth to him. And he said in interviews that when he like, cause he self-produced the Lights Out short, New Line bought it and gave him like the chance to make a feature. And he was like, that was the first time I had ever been on a professional film set.
Wow.
Was directing that movie, which is pretty nuts. He was like, I would just make my own things with my friends. But I'd never been on like a professionally run film set, and suddenly I was making like, you know, a $6 million movie, which then led to like a $20 million movie, which
he
then
needs
led
like to 200 to 300 more friends. What do you
mean? Right, right. But this also feels like a kind of like properly sized movie where someone can actually like get a chance to, I don't know, try something weird with it, you know?
Definitely.
It's not like a crazy $250 million movie.
Mm-hmm. It's cheap enough where I feel like the studio didn't really have much of an expectation of it either. It's like the character's name is Shazam. He has a big lightning bolt in his chest. Like, I don't know what's happening with this movie, but maybe it'll make money. Who knows? But Griffin, I wanted to ask you, you're also a superhero in your part time.
Sure.
What is, you know, as a superhero yourself, what is your opinion of Shazam?
You know, some people accuse me of being a sidekick, so I appreciate you calling me a superhero.
Every sidekick is a superhero. Come on.
I agree with that. I agree with that. And I think that the Tick and Arthur are co-heroes. Right. I think it's a very collaborative process. I enjoyed Shazam thoroughly. And I feel like it's kind of what I want these movies to be, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, between being like a kid who grew up reading comic books to then becoming like a massive superhero movie fan, to then becoming someone kind of feeling burnt out on all these movies and shows, while then simultaneously moving into being someone who works on one of these shows, I've had like such a weird sort of relationship with these things for so long. But I've been at this point recently where I'm just kind of like, I feel like these things have become too lumbering.
Yes. Yeah.
And these interconnected universes have become so complicated where it's very hard to just make like one movie with its own ideas that stands on its own. And Shazam like is that. And I feel like there were rumors for a while that it was going to be totally disconnected from the DC stuff, which is another reason we thought we wouldn't do it on the podcast.
Right.
But instead, it's like a movie that is in the same universe as the Zack Snyder movies and as Wonder Woman and as Aquaman, but like has its own radically different sensibility, which is kind of what I've been waiting for. Like for people to make these interconnected universes that don't have to constantly be shaking hands with the other movies and also don't need to have the exact same tone and the exact same visual aesthetic as the other movies. Because if you like read comic books, you know, all the DC books take place by and large in the same continuity, and the Marvel books take place in the same continuity, and they're radically different. Mm-hmm. They have totally different artists and totally different sensibilities, you know, and it gets a little frustrating when it feels like everything is like forced to mush somewhere into the middle.
Totally feel that.
And this is like a family comedy that also feels like a proper superhero movie. And it doesn't totally destroy the last five or six DC movies.
It's like Batman lives in Gotham City. Superman hangs out in Metropolis. The Flash is in Keystone City.
Yeah.
Shazam hangs out in Philly.
Sure.
You know, right. It's so tonally different, even to the setting. You know, it's funny that it wants to be in its own universe. It kind of doesn't matter. And it's like, no, we're here in Philadelphia, you know, a real place that exists on a map.
I mean, I feel like most people only see Philly in movies, right? So it kind of fits into that. This is like Shyamalan-esque, right? The weird other side of Philadelphia, or like a Rocky movie or something.
Yeah, this movie confirms that Bruce Wayne could have watched Rocky. Because they both exist in the same universe, right? Rocky as a movie exists in the same world that Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman live in.
And that's an interesting thing, because the Marvel universe has always been like the real world with the real cities we know and superheroes existing in them.
Right.
And DC and being large has lived off of those fake cities and fake presidents, you know?
Right.
Like the sort of like slightly different world than what we know. And this is weirdly kind of like finding a midpoint between the two that I think works really beautifully, because it makes Shazam feel kind of street level. Mm-hmm. The fact that he's in Philly, that he's not in one of these famous DC cities, that he's kind of like, you know, not as shiny as the other guys, that he's just sort of a local celebrity rather than being like a worldwide hero.
Yeah, a little Spider-Man-esque, like he's your friendly neighborhood Shazam. In a way,
and the whole game the movie is playing about, like, is he a social media star? Is he like a street busker? Is he like a real hero?
He's all of these things.
No one really knows.
He contains multitudes. Jeff, I know you're a huge comic fan and a huge DC fan. What are your feels on this movie?
Well, Devendra, I guess you could say my feelings about Shazam are best summed up in the form of a limerick.
You know, Dave is not here. You don't have to do this.
I'm trying to get him back. You know, he's so mad. Griffin, you should need some backstory.
Yes.
So Dave Chen, who you are sitting in for graciously today,
sure.
Has demanded that there be a limerick in every episode of the Slash Filmcast. He gets very angry about it. Last week, I did not deliver a limerick.
That's and true.
You wow. see the result. He's not here today.
He stormed off. Yeah.
He is so furious at me. I got angry texts. Yeah. He said, I refuse to go back on the show. So I'm just doing my part to try to get him back.
Sure, sure.
And this is my limerick review of Shazam. Okay, ready? Thank goodness Levi took the gig because he made it a movie I dig. I was delighted to find it's like someone combined Greatest American Hero and Big.
Perfect. I love it.
The last line's a little rough, but you know.
I think he's going to re-download Skype. I think it's going to work. Get your boy back.
Thank you. So, yes, I had a great time with Shazam as well, and it, that is exactly how I feel about it. Two things that I loved in my youth, The Greatest American Hero and Big, are the sensibilities of this movie. It's somebody trying to figure out how to be a superhero, which I always enjoyed with The Greatest American Hero, where it's like you got these powers. You don't know how to activate them or use them. There's so much fun in that. You know, you can remember even the first Raimi Spider-Man movie,
sure.
where Tobey Maguire is trying to figure out his spider powers. There's joy in that, in just the – and so much of this movie is that. And also the wish fulfillment thing of a little kid wishing they could be a superhero and then becoming one, and all the fun in appearing like an adult at times in the world. This movie, for the first – I don't know. I was surprised this movie was over 2 hours long.
Yeah.
And the first, I don't know, 20 minutes, everything up until Zachary Levi shows up in this movie, I was not digging. I was like, I don't know about this. It felt clunky.
That whole opening sequence is really, it's an interesting way to start this movie, basically.
Yes, it's dark. Yeah. It's super dark.
So dark.
Like, this movie is real. I don't understand, first of all, why this movie is PG-13.
Yes.
I think it should be PG. It's like they wanted it to have a little more street cred because the cool teens won't go see a PG movie. But yeah, it starts really dark. It starts really kind of clunky. There's like wizards in caves that feel a little odd. And
it feels self-aware of its campiness, but if you're not on the wavelength of the movie, you know, you could be like, this is some bullshit. Like,
it
just wasn't
working for me at all until Zachary Levi shows up, and then it instantly becomes like 1,000% more fun.
Right.
And he is having a blast, and there's the movie. It just has a great time. And I was having a great time. I was laughing out loud. I loved, as Griffin brought up, the look of this movie. It does not feel like it stands alongside the Snyderverse in any sense. It really is. Okay, it feels okay to be a little goofy and a little, you know, four color from the comic book page. It's happy to make Zachary Levi look ridiculous. And Mark Strong plays the villain, and he's just chewing scenery in a wonderful Mark Strong way.
Mark Strong plays the villain, you say? I've never seen that before. It's certainly not in a superhero movie.
Right.
Yeah, certainly not in a decent movie.
Anyway, so I had a great time with this. It has heart. It wears its heart on its sleeve. It's not afraid to be mushy and heartfelt and sincere. I love that about it. I wish more DC movies were like that. I think it's my favorite of the DC movies. I don't even know if it belongs in that grouping, quite honestly, but it's my favorite so far. And I want more in this universe. I think Zachary Levi is great. My biggest complaint of this whole movie is I never bought that he and the kid actor were the same person.
Yes. Yeah.
Because he is having way more fun than the kid is.
And the kid is like, and, you know, morose teen, yes! basically.
I don't get it. And I understand that, like, when you're the superhero, it's fun. But I feel like there should be at least some consistency between who they are moment to moment.
That's where it kind of lost me from Big, right? Because in Big, you could still tell, oh, it's that kid as an adult, just still being a kid. And in this movie, it's not quite the same.
Well, in Big, you have bookends of the kid,
right?
It's 90% Tom Hanks, right? In this movie, you're literally getting juxtaposition moment to moment of them switching back and forth. And you're like, I don't think it's the same guy. You know?
I'll also say, I mean, when we move into spoiler territory, I'll have more to say on this note. But I think a big difference with Big is that in Big, Tom Hanks is playing that kid. Like, his performance very much feels in harmony with the kid from the movie. And I don't know if he was studying that kid or watching the daily production order is, but even something like Moonlight, where you have like three actors playing the same guy at different ages, you know, or six actors playing two different characters at three different ages. Barry Jenkins has said that, like, pointedly, he never had actors meet each other,
right?
Because he didn't want them to copy each other. But especially, you know, with the main performances, they feel very much in sync with each other, and that feels like Jenkins really modulating the three of them and writing very specifically and directing them very specifically. That's probably the biggest failing of this movie, if you want to throw anything at it, is it feels like Levi is playing a kid in a superhero body, but he's not playing that kid in a superhero's
right,
body.
Definitely.
The kid should be more like Levi. Levi should be more like the kid. They should meet somewhere in the middle, whatever it is. But it does feel like it's a little nonspecific.
I wish the kid was more like Levi. I think Levi is having a great...
Sure.
Levi is the best part of this movie, in my opinion. And I feel like the kid is just doing kid stuff, and that's not his fault.
But yeah, right? he has a reason. I actually like the casting. I think the kid has a reason to be as morose as he is, because this movie goes to some dark places, like darker than I expected, ostensibly like a kid's oriented superhero movie to go. And we'll talk about some of that in spoilers. But go ahead, Jeff.
No, I that's basically it. I'm not going to lay it at the feet of that young actor. I think that there should have been a better effort to sync those up, you know, on a casting level or a directing level. And
yeah, as for my thoughts on this movie, guys, like I enjoyed it. I'm echoing everything you're saying. It feels so fun and lighthearted in a way a lot of these Warner Brothers DC movies haven't really felt. And I guess you could really say the turning point was Wonder Woman, of just like taking it out of the Snyder tude, whatever he was trying to do with those movies. And Aquaman was certainly a big exercise in like pure cinematic maximalism, and I enjoyed the heck out of, you know, Aquaman. This is another thing. Like, this is clearly trying to make like a badass kids movie, you know, like the kids who grew up watching Goonies or something. Like, I bring up Hook a lot because that's a movie I grew up with. I understand that's not a great movie, but I really love it. This one feels like, you know, a genuinely good movie that's really aimed at kids. Something we will probably talk a little more about in spoilers, though. It does feel... I kind of feel like this movie should skew younger in a weird way, just given given the tone of like the suit and what the character is. It is really scary and extra violent at times. Like, people
needlessly,
like kind of cruelly.
Doesn't get anything from that. Like, it doesn't make the movie better by doing that.
There is one scene where like a whole room of people are just massacred in a terrifying way, and then certainly I'm sure, like, I saw families bring like a bunch of young kids to this movie. This is one of those things that will scar those kids for life. And you know, it's mainly that, and also like I'm not normally much of a prude, but it is funny that this movie just says a lot of people are saying shit. Shit is one of the first lines echoed in this movie. And that's it felt weird. Like, totally, it felt like this movie didn't know if it wanted to be that sort of like wise ass teen, or if it wanted to be something a little more wholesome and more welcoming. And, you know, I don't know if that's down to the script or something.
And that reminded me of like Amblin films.
Yes. Yeah.
Like something like Gremlins, that was like ostensibly a family movie, but that was like really violent content, or like E.T. having, you know, penis breath or whatever.
Gremlins is like a straight up horror movie, you know, like Gremlins on a certain level is like this kind of visceral, and this movie just is lighthearted and fun and didn't need it, you know.
No, I agree. I mean, it's got some weird meshing of tones, whole like sort of, it makes sense that those scenes are as intense as they are, considering they hired a director coming off of two horror movies.
Sure,
But like, I was comparing it in my mind even to like Sam Raimi on the first two Spider-Man in particular, which have a couple scenes that are like weirdly intense in this sort of like grand
the Doc Ock hospital scene. This is glorious.
Right.
It's so good.
Right. But even this, like the the scenes, I won't spoil anything, but the scenes in this that are more violent feel a little more frightening and like visceral, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's down to just like this being David Sandberg's, you know, third movie and maybe not having a decent grasp of this tone, or if that's from the script or anything. It just, this is one of those things where I feel like even Spielberg starts to understand later on in life, like the, how to manage the tone of his movies. So it's not a big distraction, and I still like the movie overall. I think it's a lot of fun. Like, I have to say, like, this movie is giving me what I've wanted out of Superman for so long. And I don't know much about this character. Isn't he essentially a Superman ripoff?
Yeah, well, I don't know, ripoff.
That was the whole thing at the beginning, like, from what I have read and heard.
Well, I mean, every superhero is a Superman ripoff on a certain level. But,
I thought the creators were sued by DC because it was such a Superman ripoff.
I may not be aware of that history.
This is a weird example of like a character that was a competitor to Superman that ended up getting acquired by DC years later. And obviously was originally for a long time called Captain Marvel. A name they obviously had to drop for legal reasons as well.
Yeah, correct. But yeah, and this movie, you know, it is clearly not the Alex Ross Shazam, you know, that is, you know, majestic and regal and noble. I mean, this is, they've made a clear decision. I mean, this movie, one of the thoughts that I had watching it was like, they don't need to make a Plastic Man movie anymore. You know, like, I don't know if there was in the cards, but it like lives in the same wheelhouse as Plastic Man. Like, Plastic Man is the superhero who's always kind of goofing off and doesn't really know how to be a superhero and does goofy stuff. Like, Shazam is that now, which is, I loved it, but it's very different than traditionally what Shazam has been.
Mm-hmm. I feel like, not growing up as a huge Shazam fan, but having read comics at times or seeing him pop up in other series. And I remember watching, there was the Hanna-Barbera cartoon show, which I used to watch. There would always be this thing where, like, once they hit Shazam would just start acting like an adult superhero.
Right.
Like, you would kind of lose the kid in there. He would become kind of majestic and all-powerful and confident. There was that disconnect. And the two things I kept on thinking about watching this movie in terms of what it represents and, like, the history of superhero movies, as it were, are, A, the weird period in the 90s where and into the early 2000s, where a bunch of superheroes almost got made into like high concept comedies. Mm-hmm. Like, there's famous the Robert Smigel Black Green Lantern that never happened.
Yeah.
Where Warner Brothers was like, let someone make it into like a parody of what it is. And before Ang Lee came on to Hulk, Universal thought about doing it as an Adam Sandler movie.
Jeez,
like, there was this notion of like, there's another Jim Carrey one, I'm forgetting. I think Jim Carrey, they wanted to do Hulk as well. But like, this notion of any sort of like superhero, superpower that's more absurd like that or transformative like that, can you turn it into like a star vehicle and a big comedy? Because otherwise the mythology of the thing was always seen as like too dorky to make into an earnest movie, you know?
Right. With Marvel, you know, when Dr. Blake, the old Thor origin was Dr. Blake finds the hammer and is turned into Thor. And it's like, you don't see Dr. Blake poking through when he's Thor. He's Thor, you know, and that's how Shazam used to be. Like, once the kid could turn into Shazam, but once he's Shazam, he's full on Shazam and there's no little kid in there. And that, I think it's a fun choice to make it more like big.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what wave we're in, right? Because we're in the post second wave Marvel, I guess. So this is a new era of superhero movies, but it does feel like they're allowed to be what they are in a way. Like, Aquaman is essentially, you know, Star Wars or King Arthur underwater, and it's allowed to be as weird and rich as the creators want it to be. And I think that's really exciting between that and Wonder Woman and everything. So it's kind of cool. I'm excited about this. Certainly like this type of movie more than I am for the next Avengers.
If you were to tell me that, you know, they were going to make a bunch of DC superhero movies and I'd be more excited about Aquaman and Shazam than I was about Superman and Batman, I would have said you were nuts. But here we are.
Yeah.
Here we are.
Yeah. No, I feel the same way. And, you know, when they announced it and they said we're doing it as like big and it's going to be New Line instead of Warner Brothers and it's going to be lower budget in relation to these other gargantuan budget movies, it felt like, oh, is this sort of like a sort of throwaway? in their plan. Mm-hmm. But it now feels more indicative of what they're trying to make these movies, which are like, just figure out what the most honest version of this story and this character is. Mm-hmm. And don't worry about it having to like feed into the house of cards we're building. And, you know, in the same way that Aquaman is just like so goofy, you know, Wonder Woman is so sort of like political and emotional in terms of its sort of like commentary on humanity. Mm-hmm. And this is like, you know, at first when they were like, they're just making it into like a body swap comedy, I thought it was strange. But then you're like, no, that's what that character should have always been. Like, that's the best version to make. The other thing I kept thinking about watching this movie is like, this coming so shortly after Zack Snyder at his Snyder Fest or whatever it was, where he made his like, you know, if you think Superman isn't embezzling money, you're not living in the real world.
Oh,
comics.
Geez.
Yeah.
Right. I feel like so much of the Zack Snyder thing, which like the DC universe was sort of forged in this modern era, was him being like, I want to make all these heroes broken and corrupt, you know, and sort of morally bankrupt, because he's not a guy who, by his own admission, really believes in the idea of like pure heroism. Sure. And he finds that kind of childish.
It's a really cynical worldview that this was all built on, right, for sure.
And when he was making Watchmen, he kept saying that in interviews where he was like, this is the only superhero movie I could ever make. I don't get Superman. I think he's a loser. Like, you can find those interviews. And he would just be like, I like people who are like broken and corrupt. Mm-hmm. And then the fact that they let him like make the first three movies and sort of form this universe is kind of nuts. But this is a movie that like deals with serious real world issues, but it doesn't feel like it's in a cynical sort of performative way. You know, and this is a movie that deals with a kid who's like a victim of the foster system, you know, who's been like abandoned by his parent and is like acting up. And there's like real emotional trauma in this movie. But it's
let's get to spoilers.
Like,
let's jump to that.
Yeah.
So let's move on to spoilers for Shazam.
Now you're looking for the secret.
You're going to see this coming.
No.
But you won't find it because, of course,
you're not going to see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret now.
You want to be fooled.
I mean, that's what's kind of interesting to me, is that spoilers for this movie are both, A, how much weirder and more sort of big scale comic booky it becomes in the last like 30 minutes.
Yes.
And B, how much more emotionally deep it is than the trailer sold. Because I feel like the trailer's really just sold like Shazam's going to do the Dougie.
Kid becomes superhero and that's it.
Right.
And I don't think there was any mention of like him being an adopted kid and him living in a foster family or any of that stuff. And that honestly worked so well because we rarely see that in a movie like this, and certainly done so well like this.
The poster of him blowing a bubble in his mouth and on the cell phone is just sinister when you realize how dark this movie really is. Like,
oh yeah. Yeah.
That poster is like, oh my God, let's bring the whole
family. Funny.
It's going to be a heartwarming.
Whereas the actual movie is like, your mother doesn't love you. Deal with it.
Yes. The first 10 minutes of this movie is literally like the worst father berating his son and then getting into a horrible car accident. It's like, what movie did we step into? I want the bubblegum movie.
Who's that actor, by the way, the father actor? Isn't he also from Smallville?
John Glover.
Also playing terrible father in Smallville?
Yes. He played Lex Luthor's dad on Smallville.
Same thing.
Yeah, he's like a classic bad dad. I'll say, I mean, I think truly the darkest thing I have ever seen in any superhero movie, non-hyperbolically, is the scene where Billy sees his mother and she's like, yeah, no, I knew.
Jeez.
I knew. No, I
let you be taken away by the car. It is so horrific what she tells him.
Oh, man.
To his face.
I mean, that's true darkness, you know? It's branding someone with a batarang. You know, but that's like, that's the kind of stuff they usually hide from these movies.
I would rather my parents be gunned down in an alley by a robber than have my mom say, I didn't want you.
Oh, man. I wanted to interview...
raised by cops.
It's insane. I want to interview the kids. Like, there were scores of families in the theater that I saw this movie. I saw it at the Nighthawk near Prospect Park. So it's all Park Slope families. And, like, it's a big family theater. And I wanted to know, how did this movie hurt them? Because, guys, I remember there's that scene in Hook formative movie for me where, you know, Peter Pan talks about how he was just kind of like left alone. Like he, you know, what, his carriage was just like escorted away and his mother lost him and like Tinkerbell had to save him. And that idea of a baby just losing their mother was so sad to me as a child. And this is even more hardcore. This isn't just like an accident. This is like the mom being maliciously just abandoning her child. This is There Will Be Blood in a superhero movie.
Twice.
Yeah.
She saw an opportunity and she took it.
I've abandoned my child.
The opportunity was to abandon her son.
Oh, man.
The other scene that's super jacked up, too, is Mark Strong striding into his dad and brother's office and straight up murdering them and feeling nothing. And then there's like a song about family in the elevator. And as he's leaving, it's like played for laughs that he had like just committed patricide. It's insane.
This is kind of how, David Sandberg's coming out of like horror movie mentality. Like it did feel like, I can just have a bloodbath for a time in this movie. And maybe we didn't have to go that far, guy. I don't know.
But there is something to horror directors making good superhero
directors, surprisingly.
You know, between Raimi and James Wan. Was the Omen before Superman or after? I was like trying to compile the list in my head of like superhero directors who did horror movies beforehand.
I don't know.
That's a good question.
But there is something I think in terms of the tone management you need for superhero movies, even though we're talking about how sometimes the tone on this movie isn't 100% in line. There is something in horror movies where they often have to balance like high comedy and sort of like very visceral thrills, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. And I think that the reason this movie gets away with as horrific and sort of heart-wrenching as it is because it balances it on the other side with some really deeply heartwarming things the dynamic of the foster family is legitimately lovely. And the parents are depicted in not like a fairy tale nice way, but just a down to earth. It's hard. Life's tough.
Yeah. But it's supportive. So it's, supportive.
Yes.
Yeah.
Supportive and but like thinking it through, and they don't have all the answers, but they're trying it, and the kids themselves are really interesting and supportive, and I think it's a well drawn, sensitive sort of nuanced take on that I think really makes it work, and his journey, Billy Batson's journey to feeling a familiar bond with them is earned. Like I don't think the movie takes any shortcuts with it. It really feels like he does come to understand that, and we all go, it's important.
Another bit of tone management, by the way, in this movie, the point where teenage boys run into a disabled child and just like start beating him up too and making fun of him after hitting him with their car.
Yeah, and nobody seems to be upset about that except our hero. Yeah.
This is kind of hilarious. I laughed out loud when that happened. That may make me a terrible person. But guys, we're talking about family. This movie is really all about hashtag family, as I think the best movies are these days. I did not see the, what do we call the Shazam family? The Shazamily? I didn't see
the
that.
The Shazamily.
Yeah,
that's good.
I mean, I'll say the most restraint I have ever seen, or not ever seen, but have seen the marketing department of a film of this size use in a long time.
Yeah.
Because to have something as money as all the kids becoming superheroes and not spoil that, to spoil so little of the movie in the trailers, is one of the reasons why I think this film is such an enjoyable watch. You know, as
100%,
opposed
I agree 100%.
To so many films of this size where it feels kind of like pre-digested before you've seen it. You've had like a bunch of trailer breakdowns where even if they're not telling every plot point, the images and everything, you can kind of figure it out. And people have the sort of movie piece together in their mind and they're just checking it off as they go along. It was kind of fascinating to watch this movie, get two scenes in the opening that I did not expect to be in this movie, have almost everything in the trailer accomplished by minute like 45, and have no idea where this movie was going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that the Shazamily reveal and how it plays out is so freaking fun. It is so much fun. The casting is delightful. That wish fulfillment, just the idea of that, is so awesome.
Yeah.
And it's a home run from that moment. And you're right. Like, to the fact that somebody was like, no, we're not revealing that. We're not going to show that.
It's going to make the movie better if people discover this on their own.
Kids are going to cheer everywhere.
Right. I mean, it's such a satisfying payoff. The other thing is, I mean, and I was sort of teasing this when we were talking earlier, but I feel like Adam Brody and Megan Good in particular are so good and are so clearly playing the same kids.
Yes.
You know, as their younger actors. In a way that the Levi Billy thing, what's his name, who plays young Billy, the way they don't sync up from the second Megan Good starts talking, you're like, that's Darla, you know? The second they reveal Adam Brody, you're like, that's brilliant casting. And he so fully feels like that same Jacqueline Grazer character in this bigger body. I mean, it's really, really satisfying. And it also has that thing. I mean, we keep on talking about Spider-Man a lot. But I think it's only as like a positive comparison. This movie has the thing that I love in like great Spider-Man movies and cartoons and everything, where it is dovetailing of the personal life and the superhero conflict, where that moment where he realizes the only way to get out of this and save the day is also for him to stop fighting the thing he's been fighting in his personal life, you know, that he needs to learn to accept that this is his family and he needs to use the family to beat the bad guys is like, that's like why I like superhero stories. Yes. When you can have those moments where just everything like sort of coalesces at one moment, a perfect dovetail, and it becomes this sort of like totally ecstatic payoff of just like five big kids and giant brightly colored costumes punching the seven deadly sins. Another thing I think is insane was not in the trailers at all, that they're literally fighting the manifestation of seven deadly sins.
But it's also, if they're like imprisoned, shouldn't there be like no sin in the world? I don't know about the logistics of this whole thing, but
the world still feels pretty crappy.
Everything's still going on. I will say the Adam Brody reveal kind of, it was shocking and a little fun because I love the OC when that was on the air. It is really funny to see Adam Brody and Zachary Levi, two guys from teen shows, ostensibly in the 2000s, now as superheroes. Like, live long enough to see your nerds be superheroes, basically.
You'll get there. The other crazy thing is you have Adam Brody and DJ Catrona. He's playing the grown-up Pedro.
Yeah.
And DJ Catrona was supposed to be Superman in the George Miller Justice League.
Oh, really?
And Adam Brody was supposed to be the Flash.
Yes, yeah.
So you have two of the failed George Miller Superman, Justice League team, rather, now getting to like play superheroes.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Anything else you guys want to mention about this movie? I feel like we've kind of talked as much as we can about it. I'm really excited to see where they go. Like, given how successful it's been, I think the sequel is already greenlit with the same screenwriter. So it seems like that's a go.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like there's a lot of places they could take this story.
You gotta call the sequel Shazam's, right?
Yes.
Shazamily.
Or Shazamily.
Yeah. Shazamily.
Dwayne Johnson weirdly ends up with an executive producer credit on this movie because he signed up to play Black Adam like 5 or 6 years ago.
That's the gig to get, man, is the you get the money, see, you get that executive producer money, and you didn't have to even show up. He just said, I'd do it, and then doesn't do it, but still gets the money. That's pretty good, if you can get that.
Right. And at the time, I think it was when they thought they were going to make a more serious Shazam movie. And then at some point, he announced, like, we're spinning it off Black Adam's own movie, which felt like a weird prospect. But now after seeing this, I'm, like, so much more in favor of The Rock having his own badass Black Adam movie. And maybe they cross paths at some point in Shazam 3. But you make another Shazam movie with this kind of tone. I mean, the only thing I want to say is, selfishly, I mean, you know, we've been talking about the question of how traumatizing is this going to be from children. And I certainly have heard a lot of people like talking about hearing the cries when like John Glover's like head gets eaten off and stuff. I saw this movie at like an 11 p.m. showing. because I was hearing so many good things about it that I was just like, screw it. I'm just going to like go out and see by myself and went to the theater two blocks away. So I saw it without any kids in the audience. And for me, like, even though I was sometimes like keeping in mind, like, oh, this is a lot more violent and dark than I thought this movie would be from the advertising, I didn't have to deal with any traumatized kids. So selfishly for me, I was like, I really love how weirdly this movie is playing with tones.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in a way that reminds me of like Sam Raimi and Peter Jackson and these guys who would make horror movies that were like very visceral and very goofy and very romantic, you know, and corny and like brutal and all of that sort of stuff. You know, I don't know how well it's going to play with families everywhere. I wonder if this is going to be one of those movies like Return to Oz that like we grew up watching being like, that was weirdly kind of dark in retrospect.
Yeah.
If it's going to be the movie that like kids remember being like the first time they were scared in a theater. But if the kids don't leave, the payoff is so strong that it's not a movie that I think is going to like leave you nightmares in a weird way because it ends on such a positive note of like catharsis, you know? Yeah.
All the kids in my screening were shouting Shazam at the end.
Oh, yeah.
They're like, the credits were rolling and they were shouting Shazam. So,
yeah. But,
and that, like, that rules. Like, that's why superhero movies should exist. Like, it's great if adults can enjoy them too. I want them to be legitimate movies. But, like, anytime people are like, this is a version of Joker that kids would hate, you know?
Yeah.
Or all, like, people saying, like
that's a
Batman
virtue.
Would scare children. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, if you make a Batman movie that no kid will enjoy, I think you failed.
Yep.
I agree 100%. 100%.
It should work for every kid, and it should work for adults as well. But if you're out there explicitly trying to make a superhero movie to scare children, unless it's like Watchmen, I think that's kind of messed up.
Totally messed up. Dude, you guys, as I was watching this movie, I was thinking of The Kid Who Would Be King, the Joe Cornish movie that just came out. And I was thinking, you know, this would be a great double feature with that movie, except The Kid Who Would Be King, I think, knows tonally. It does a better job of being a kids movie. That's a PG movie. It is a little more wholesome. Yeah. There's certainly like peril and violence and everything, but it's not as, it's more cartoonish and it's not as like deep and affecting as this. So maybe that's kind of what I was hoping to, like, I would have liked a better double feature just so like I have young nieces and nephews and I'd love to like introduce them to this movie and also be able to show them, you know, Shazam. But, you know, I guess I could be that, you know, that uncle who shows kids inappropriate
cool
stuff sometimes.
Uncle.
I'm the cool
the
guy.
Cool right. uncle.
Yeah. It's good to be the cool guy.
I have three things I want to say before we wrap. One is one scene we haven't mentioned, I think is my favorite scene in the whole movie, is the, like, the 7-Eleven scene, which is very early on in the Zachary Levi appearance. And it just is a delight. Like, the idea of buying beer and then realizing it's not even good. Like, how it treats all of that stuff is so smart and funny and well done, well executed. Like, actually has a good message for kids, but doesn't ignore the fact that if you were an adult, you'd probably, you know, it's just so smart and well done. Secondly, and this goes to what we were just talking about, the idea that this movie exists contemporaneously with the superhero movies we've seen so far, and there's still a character in it that like idolizes Superman and Batman. It makes no sense at all. You know, like that kid idolizes Superman and Batman, but what we know about Superman and Batman based on the movies are in this universe, it makes no sense. It's crazy.
It does feel like they're quietly trying to like retcon those specific performances and depictions while keeping in the world. But it is a thing that I find is often missing from modern superhero movies, is the sense of their relationship to the public and vice versa, you know? And it's great that like, so you always get the sense of like, you know, how the citizens feel about these heroes.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Also, we got a shout out to the final shot of this movie, which I think is Chef's Kiss. It's perfect. It's so good.
It's pretty wonderful. It's pretty wonderful. Yeah. But I will say, and that was the third thing I was going to say, is that it's a cool little bonus scene. Although as soon as you see that Superman outfit walk in, it like, just the juxtaposition between the outfit and the Shazam outfit, it's like we're in completely different universes here, man.
Yeah.
But it was still a cool moment.
Definitely a cool moment. It's definitely like they are sort of reconning it, whereas I think in the Snyder Superman movies, it felt like people were afraid of Superman. You know, he was this weird evil alien and everybody hated him and his father told him don't save people for some reason.
Right.
Let's retcon it. It's fine. Let's forget that happened and let's make it better and somebody the kids can love.
Somebody that would show up in a cafeteria and not terrify every child.
Definitely. He's like, oops,
yeah,
oh,
and
man.
I also totally in favor of not feeling the need to hard reboot it and be like, we're going to set up a new, different Superman in this movie. Like, right. Let's just like slowly try to course correct how cynical those characters were.
And I guess it starts by just surrounding them with the more fun characters. So it's like, yeah, maybe Shazam will play a better role at some point in Aquaman and Wonder Woman. Like, they were the best parts of Justice League, too. So I guess that kind of makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and even that, like, the colors are so muted on that Superman suit.
Yeah.
And you guys were saying how, like, four color Shazam is. Mm-hmm. There's, like, a really nice sort of, like, juxtaposition in this movie where, like, the suit is so bright. It's so classic comic booky. They don't put any effort into trying to make it look badass.
Right.
He's
right.
giving this broad comedy performance. But then it's, like, shot in real Philadelphia. Which is like kind of damp and murky and they're not in the best neighborhood.
Not the brightest city in the world, yeah.
Right. And it's like it pops more when you have this like big bright hero existing in a more tangible real world than when you have like a desaturated suit in a sort of desaturated image in a fictional city. And then the whole thing just feels kind of depressing, you know?
Yeah, it just shows in stark contrast what a I think, in my opinion, bad idea it is to even try. Like, let the color be the not fit in the world. Like, that's the point. Superman is an alien from a different place. Like, let him be bright and shining and a beacon. Anyway, that's a different argument.
They're like aspirational figures. They're like a break from how bad the real world is. That's why we tell superhero stories, because we hate the actual world we live in. Right. Unless you're Zack Snyder and he wants to make movies about how much he hates the world we live in.
Oh, man. Well, Griffin, I'll let you have the final word here. I do want to ask you, who do you think would win in a fight, the Tick or Shazam?
It's tough. I mean, I think they get along really well.
That would actually be hilarious.
Yeah. And you guys talking about like just how canny it was when you saw the posters with Shazam on the cell phone and the bubble gum. Mm-hmm. I felt such a deep sense of jealousy when I saw those posters. It's interesting. I mean, they're both, you know, Shazam has a greater breadth of power sets.
Yes.
There's more he can do. But the Tick seems pretty unstoppable. He's nigh invulnerable, as they say. Shazam is literally a kid in a superhero's body. And the Tick is like an adult superhero.
Yeah.
Right, who maybe has the brain of a child, but not literally.
They would certainly get along. That'd be fun.
Right. I think that's the thing. I think it would just diffuse, you know? There's a big thing in the new season of the Tick that we just had come out where Tick is trying to hug fight people to diffuse tension. And I feel that's the thing. Like, they would just want to hang out, you know?
Oh, man, I would love to see that for sure. Well, thank you guys. That's going to be a wrap for this episode of the Slash Filmcast. As always, you could drop us an email at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a review, you know, or subscribe on your podcaster of choice. Griffin Newman, where can people find you on the internet these days?
I'm Griff Lightning on all social media platforms. It's like Grease Lightning, except with the first half of my name.
I get it.
I'm told it's terrible for search engine optimization. I'm constantly getting tagged the wrong way. Blink Check, wherever podcasts are found. I mean, film critic David Sims of The Atlantic, who was just on your guys' show.
Yeah, he's so much fun.
We're just finishing up Tim Burton now, and we'll shortly announce our next director, who is very much the opposite of Tim Burton.
Oh, I'm excited for that. I just finished.
I won the Tim Burton argument, and then David won the next one.
Oh.
Yes.
Now I'm interested. I just finished your Dark Shadows episode, and that certainly made revisiting that bad movie worth it, I'd say.
That's what we go for. And then hopefully to try to expose people to good movies they've never seen and rewatch good movies they have seen.
Definitely.
We try to do everything. That was the least specific statement I ever did. Tick Season 2 is on Amazon right now. I'll say if you like Shazam, I think it's similar in tone. We certainly try to balance the same sort of weird absurdity and humor and the emotional stakes. There's a weird family show in the middle of this crazy superhero battle and talking lobsters. And
it's so much fun.
I think cool fight scene.
Is this the the fourth iteration of the Tick at this point? Like including the comics, the original animated show. Right. There's been so much.
And they all have their own totally different continuities, but they've all been the same guy, Ben Edlund, which is like very unique because they don't let, they didn't let Stan Lee write every Spider-Man movie.
Right, right.
And Ben Edlund gets to keep on doing this. So I grew up as a big fan of the Tick. It's crazy that I get to do it for a living. I hope I get to keep doing it. But if you want to help me keep doing it, watch the show right now on Amazon Prime.
All right. And Jeff Cannata, where can we find you?
Ah, so fun having you, Griffin. That was a blast. You can find me on Twitter at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. I also do a video game podcast. If you want to hear me talk about video games, check out DLC, which you can find anywhere you get fine podcasts, or by visiting 5by5.tv/DLC.
Excellent. And you can find me at Devendra on Twitter. I write about tech at engadget.com. I'm also doing a tech Q&A show at nomoretech.net. That's no with a K. And that's it for me. Thanks for joining us on the Slash Filmcast. We are out. Shazam! We watch the movies, flicks, tracks for the good. That is the Slash Filmcast. For all the news and the movies coming out, because you know that it's the thing worth talking about.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.